3. If you would like a physical Bible, please raise your hand and one of the ushers will hand you one. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. I said to myself, God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. I also said to myself, as for humans, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless. All go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. Who knows if the human spirit rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work, because that is their lot. For who can bring them to see what will happen after them?
Okay, let's have a look. Right. Okay. Well, we continue our series on Ecclesiastes, but let me begin. I remember when I was in high school, one thing I hated at high school was English. I hated English. I hated writing essays. So it doesn't, I don't get it when you got people like Lydia who actually loves English, and you got Isaac Nee who actually teaches English and tutors English, and I just hated English. And so when I, because I failed, I passed chemistry, maths and physics and all that thing, but English was the one thing I failed. And you know why? Because I misread the question. How ironic is that, right? But anyway, when I finished high school, I had to look for another course. I looked for any course and that once the word English came, or essay, I said, let's forget that. So therefore, I chose engineering. And why? Because there's no essay writing. Until after I signed up, I realized there was a thesis. And that scared me no end. And then later on, guess what? God calls me into ministry, goes to Bible college, and writing essays is all what college is all about. And so, you know, it was the dread of my life. But that being said, there is some value of learning English literature. There is some value, because sometimes in the history of English literature, there are sayings and proverbs and things that have become iconic and gone down in history as something for everyone to remember. And one of them is this one. Hamlet. Who knows Hamlet? Who knows Hamlet? Oh yes, you all know Hamlet. This is a very famous saying. Though this be madness, yet there is method in it. It was to explain Hamlet's erratic behavior. Why is he acting so crazy? And the person responds, though this be madness, yet there is method in it. I think it's actually quite, and when you think about it, it's quite not only a very famous saying, but in many ways it captures the essence of what we're looking at today in Ecclesiastes chapters 3 to 5. Because the book, this section can be broken into those two twin ideas. On the one hand, chapter 3 talks about method in this madness. And then when you go to chapter 4, it all seems like just a big, big mess. And so today I want to break it up into those two categories of method and madness. But before we do that, let's remind ourselves about Ecclesiastes. If you're new here or you've never read the book of Ecclesiastes, it needs to be understood that Ecclesiastes fits within a category of books known as the wisdom literature. There are the law, which covers the first five books of the Old Testament, from Genesis right to Deuteronomy. And there are the prophets, and there are the writings. And the writings is usually bigger than the wisdom literature that includes Psalms and Song of Songs. But under the writings, there's this category called wisdom literature, which is where you find the book of Job and the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. And those three books need to be read together. They cover really how to live, how to think about life and how to live life in this sort of messed up world. Proverbs, you could say, talks about the consistency of the world. Look at Job, talks about the contradictions we see in the world. And you look at Ecclesiastes, talks about the confusion we see in the world. And all three books are very important to be read together if you really want to understand how life works in this world. Well, as we come back to Ecclesiastes, remember, Ecclesiastes is written traditionally by Solomon. Solomon is the richest guy in the world at the time. And he wants to find out what life is all about. And so what does he do? He goes on this search to find out what meaning is all about. Because he's got all the resources under his belt, he's got money, he's got power, everything. He's got endless resources to go on this quest. So he goes partying to find out, is life all about being happy? He goes on and looks at all his achievements, all about success. He goes on in terms of wisdom, it's all about knowledge and things like that. And what does he discover? It's all a dead end. So when you come to chapters 3 to 5, he continues on this journey, and Dan will continue on the journey next week when he looks at chapter 5 onwards. But we continue on this journey of what is life really all about? Now, Winston finished off on that question. We pick it up from last week. So let's start with this first thing that really is about method. There is method in the madness and the mess we see in this world. And you see this idea in the opening chapter of chapter 3. Now, this might be a bit small for those in the back there, if you're particularly on the older generation, but I would encourage you to also have your own physical Bible, just in case it's too small. But you notice here what it says here, that there is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the sun. He talks about time to be born, a time to die, plant, uproot, to heal, tear down, build on, so on and so forth. Now, it's easy when he says here that there's a time for everything. The idea is that there's a certain rhythm and a pattern about life. There's a certain clockworkness about life, that things just work to clockwork. That's why he says there's a time for everything. Now, it's in one sense we can understand and see that in the rhythm of life. There is the regular season. We've now entered into spring. There is the predictability about blossoming. Flowers blossom at a certain time and so on and so forth. There's the sun that rises, the sun that sets, the rotation of the moon around the earth, etc., etc. So when you look at that, that makes sense, doesn't it? There's a season for everything. But I want you to notice that he wants to say actually more than that. Because notice what he says here, and it's in the sort of highlight, the yellow bits, which may not come as clear there. But you notice what he says there. There is a time to die. There's a time to kill. In verse 4, there's a time to weep and mourn. In verse 8, there's a time to hate. Although it's interesting in the translation that was read out, is a time for war and a time for peace. Now that's, if you pause and think about that, that's actually strange, isn't it? Because when you think about killing and weeping and mourning and war and peace, we think there is no time for that sort of thing. Those are things that we want to run away from, hide away. And in fact, we don't want to see times like that. We don't want to see times of killing. We don't want to see times when we have to weep and mourn and times of war and peace and things like that. We think to ourselves, that's actually crazy. But what he says, quite the contrary. There actually is a time for these sorts of things. There is a clockwork precision in how all this works and fit together. A clockwork precision. In other words, everything, not just the good things, but even what we think are the bad things, they all have their time and they all have their place in the whole rhythm of life. Think about that. Everything, war, peace, weeping, mourning, killing, they all have their very strange place in the whole scheme of things. Now, to drive this point home further, look what he says in verse 11. Let's pick up from verse 9. What do workers gain from their toil? I've seen the burden. I've seen the burden God has laid on the human race. And not this, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Do you hear what it's saying? Everything, not just simply has its place, but everything is beautiful in its place. Now that's a strange thought, isn't it? Like I said, how can you say that war and peace is beautiful in its place? How can you say that weeping and mourning is beautiful in its place? Now, let's be clear. He's not saying that they are good in and of themselves. But what it is saying, what he's saying is that when he looks at the world, they all play an important role in their overall scheme of things. There is a clockwork precision about things. You could say there is method in the madness we see in the world. There's precision, there is order, there's a season for everything. But he wants to go further than that. There is order, but there is purpose as well. So in other words, it's not just that we see something fits together. The most obvious question is, what does it do? What function does it play? And that's when you come to the next verse. Have a look at what he says here. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. So you can see that what God does in the world, there's an endurability, a permanence about it. But notice what he says. God does it so that people will fear him. That is the purpose. So that people will fear him. Listen to what he's saying there. Everything that happens in the world, everything that we see, the madness of this world, and even the madness in your own life, all fits together with clockwork precision. Why? So that we can fear God. Now stop and think about that for a moment for yourself. I'm sure if you look back over the year, there have been good times, and I'm sure there have been hard times. And for some of us, it has been really dark times. There are times when plans have not just not gone well, but have actually gone tragically bad. There are times when we've had real good relationships, But then there are times when we feel the sting of a broken relationship. There are times when we finally got the job that we wanted and then discover it becomes a nightmarish, hellish job. There are times when we've been doing great in terms of our help and then next thing you know, tragic news hits us. And what's going on here? And Solomon tells us there's a time for everything. And all of that fits together with clockwork precision. They fit together and they are beautiful. For what purpose? To lead you to the fear of God. To lead you to the fear of God. Now, how important is all that? Look at what he says here in chapter 3, verses 15, 17. Whatever has, I said, whatever has already been and what has been, whatever is has already been, what will be has been before, and God, now this will call the past to account. I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. I said to myself, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. He says that there will be a day of judgment in which all that we do and say will be assessed and held accountable. Now you ask, well, what's that got to do with the price of eggs? So how does that fit into the thing? And you know what it means? It means that everything we do actually matters. If you're asked to do something and there is no end to it, there is no way to assess its value, then you ask, well, why bother doing it? But by the very fact that we are to do what we do, there's a day of judgment, means that everything we say and do matters. In other words, you matter. In the great cosmos of things, the very things that you do in this world, in the very moments that you experience at this moment, the things that you think, the things that you say to each other when you go out there and the circumstances and the madness of the thing, how you react, what you say, what you do in that very moment actually matters to God. You might not think it matters to you, others might not think it matters, but to God, it matters. It matters to him. So much so that he will hold that to account. Now here's the interesting point. And the interesting point is, we see this, that most people don't get that. Most people don't get that. You see, the funny thing is that people know, they see the mess, but they know there's something bigger that's going on, but they can't work it out. They know there's something important, but they can't work out the scheme of things. And this is what the Solomon discovered in verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in his time, like he said. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. And what's he saying here? He's saying in the heart of every single person who's lived, every single person, there is a sense that there is more to life than meets the eye. There is something more. There has to be something more. When I talked about this last week, about this desire for more and more and more, we are not content with the very transitory nature of our existence. We're not content with just here today and gone tomorrow. We are always crying out for something. There's got to be something bigger than just what I experience day to day, 7 days a week. There's got to be something much more permanent than simply I'm here today and about so many years I'm gone. Something more enduring. And why is it that we sense this and feel this? Because God has placed eternity in our hearts. You think about it. Why is it that we have headstones for people who've passed away. We want to remember them. We don't just want to forget them. We have photos of loved ones because we want to remember them. We want a sense of permanency. We want to achieve something because we want to what? Leave a legacy. And that's explained by what Solomon sees here, that God has placed eternity in our hearts. Eternity in our hearts. And yet, as he says there, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. No one can fathom that. We sense it, but we still can't fully grasp it. Nevertheless, what Solomon has recognized is there is still nevertheless this clockwork precision about the madness we see. God has put everything together in clockwork precision for this one goal that people would learn to fear him. There is madness, you could say. There is method in this madness. Now, in chapter 3, Solomon talks about this, as I said, method of madness. Now, the crazy thing we call life is all put together, but here's the thing. You can only understand that if you understand God. But we also know that a lot of people don't believe in God. A lot of people reject this whole idea of God. So there is no God. There's none of this method that you talk about. It's just all madness. Okay, well, let's pull God out of the picture. Let's pull God out of the picture at the moment. And what is the purpose of life? What is the meaning of life? So I decided to, let's pull God out. So let's check out, and I went to our sort of trusted Bible called Google. I didn't actually chat GPT, I joined Google, right? What do some people think is the, how do they explain what life is about? What is the purpose and meaning of life? Well, one of my favorite heroes, Steve Jobs, okay? What does he think life is about? How does it define the meaning of life? Have the courage to follow your heart and intuition, then they somehow know what you truly want to become. That's what he thinks life is all about when you don't have God. Or another statement he said, the only way to do great work is to love what you do. Oh, that makes sense. Very inspiring. What about Walt Disney? Our famous Walt Disney. All our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. So in other words, you make up the dream. What is life about? You dream it up. And if you have the courage, you can fulfill your dreams. Or even the famous Dolly Parton. Here's a great one from Dolly Parton. If you don't like the road you're walking, start paving another one. Now, there's some of the things that people say what life is about, finding purpose, finding meaning in life, and finding a happy life. These are some of the roads. This is another one by Robert Byrne. The purpose of life, here's a cool one. The purpose of life is a life of purpose. Very nice, isn't it? But the problem is, you take God out of the picture, what do you actually see? You see madness. That's what you see. A complete mess. Absolute complete. So what do you see? Have a look at chapter 4, right? Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Again, I looked and I saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressor and they have no comforter. And what's he actually saying here? If you take a hard, honest look at life, what do you see? Oppression upon oppression upon oppression. That's what you see. And you know the funny thing is, when you see oppression like that, what you see all around us, and notice what he says there, right? There is, I saw, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressor. You think that power, people in the positions of power, should be the ones who bring comfort and safety and rescue. But no, they were the oppressors. But here's the funny thing. You take that, and then you put that next to Steve Jobs, and you say, that doesn't make sense. You see the sort of famine in Africa caused by oppression, and then you have Steve Jobs saying here, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow know what you truly want to become. Well, that sounds nice, but that does not make sense of what he sees in the world. It's just nothing more than a feel good. Or this one here by Dolly Parton, you put again next to the terrible conditions you see in Africa around the world. And what do you say to them? If you want to understand your situation, this is what you got to do. If you don't like the road you're walking, start paving another one. I mean, how ridiculous is that? You start to think to yourself, all these nice, inspiring quotes about what life is about are said by people who buried their heads in the sand. It makes no sense whatsoever. When you take God out of the picture, what do you see? Just absolute madness, an absolute mess. What else does he see? He sees futility upon futility upon futility. Have a look what he reads. What he says there in verse 4. And I saw that all toil or achievement spring from one person's envy of another. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. This is the reality of our world when there is no God. That is people simply trying to claw their way to the top over and above everyone else. And what's the problem with that? Have a look at verse 7-8. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling? He asked. And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless. Do you hear what he's actually saying? All this hard work to get to the top, to be successful, what does it achieve? Absolutely nothing. There's no one you can pass it on to. It will die with you. And worse still, you're so driven by the need to get ahead, to be successful, to get ahead of the pack, there is no contentment, no joy. This relentless need to be number one, and for what end? And this is the tragedy of it all, isn't it? This is the tragedy of all. People working long hours to be successful, to make a name of something, to get the promotion. And yet, what does Solomon discover? There's no contentment, no joy, no legacy. And that's a tragedy. This is what Solomon sees. But my question is, do you see this? Do you see this? We are so, so busy. You know, talk to people at uni, you uni students. What's a common refrain? I'm busy. Tired. You talk to them at work. What's a common refrain? I'm busy. I'm tired. We never have time to rest. Never have time to enjoy ourselves. That's the irony. Never have time to enjoy ourselves. I had a friend many years ago who used to come home. He used to come here, but no longer. He's busting his guts to make a business for himself and to please his clients. But guess what in the end happened? He destroyed his marriage. Wow. I know a person who was a successful doctor. Marriage, so successful doctor, but guess what? Marriage separated. His kids were totally a mental nutcase. I was talking to a young man the other day, finance sector, and he sadly said to me that everyone in his team is divorced. Because you're going to survive in the finance world, everything else is second fiddle to making money. I was talking to another guy just the other day. His wife is a very, very successful doctor, probably the top of the field in terms of gynecology. She is so, so much in demand. The waiting list is literally months. Invited around the world to speak at conferences. But here's the funny thing: she's so busy, she doesn't have time for her husband. So busy, she doesn't have time to rest. So busy, her weekends are packed out from one preparation after another, after another, after another. No time to rest. And that's a tragedy. That's the tragedy of it all. That's what Solomon sees. Let me ask you, do you see that? Do you actually see that? And I actually want to say to some of you young guys who are now in high school and university, some of you bought into the lie. You push yourself to get the top marks. At what expense? Everything else. You push yourself to get to the top career. At what expense? You lose your relationships, lose friends, you lose your health, you lose time. You don't have time for anything else. You just go from one job to another, from one time schedule to another. And then worse still, you lose your faith. And what's his conclusion? Success is meaningless, absolute meaningless. Look at what he says here. Then he goes on to see this other thing. He hides a story about a young man, a poor guy, who becomes successful. Listen to what he says in chapter 4, verse 13. Better poor but wise youth than old but foolish king who no longer knows how to heed a warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship or may have been born in poverty with his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless. Now, what's he actually saying? He's telling the story of a guy, a poor man, who rises to become the king's successor. Fantastic. It's a dream from rags to riches. When he gets to the top, guess what? No one's happy with him. It's always the case. And when he and not only no one, everyone's clawing for his position. But that's the pattern of life. Everyone gets to the top. And when you get to the top, guess what? Everyone complains about you and they pull you down. Then the next one gets to the top. And guess what? Very short after that, everyone starts complaining about you. And the next one gets to the top. Everyone starts complaining about you and it's an endless chain. And what's his conclusion here? And I saw that all toil and all cheating spring from one person's envy another. This too is meaningless. See why? Why is it you want to get the top and one brings you down? Because everyone is driven by envy and jealousy. You want to get the top because you want to be better than everyone. But guess what? So does everyone else. You go for the top position, everyone else is going for the top position. They're trying to outdo you. And what's his conclusion? The whole thing's just madness. You take God out of the picture. This is what we see in the world. Absolute madness. Okay, let's take God out, but let's put God back in the picture. Let's put God back in the picture. And so when we turn to chapter 5, that's when he brings God back in the picture. But when you put God in the picture, he wants to give a very strong warning. Because what does he say in chapter 5, verse 1? Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Go near to listen rather than to offer sacrifices of fools who do not know what they do wrong. And what's he saying here? You want to bring God back in the picture, that's great. But remember, you come before God to fear him, to listen to him, not to use him. In this particular section from verses 1 to 7, it goes a lot about talking about words and making empty promises and coming with dreams. In fact, you look at what he says there in verse 7. Much dreaming and many words are meaningless. So here's a person who, yes, let's bring God back in the picture. But here's the thing, I've got all my ideas, I've got all these words, I want to ask God this sort of thing, I've got all my dreams and my fantasies, I want to bring it to God and say, God, just do something with me, this sort of thing. They're not coming to fear God, they're coming to use God. Religion has become commercialized. Religion has become nothing more for this guy, for this thing. Part of the madness of the world. We just now call it religion. We now call it God. No. You want to come back to God, guard your steps. You come to God to listen. You don't come to God with your words for him to listen to you. But you come to God to listen to His words and what? To learn to fear Him. And why? Because isn't that the very purpose for everything that's happened in the world? The very purpose. To fear God. Well, let's then wrap it up. Let's bring it up. When you take God out of the picture, what do you see? A world that's completely mad and chaotic and mess. It doesn't make sense. But when you put God back in the picture, then things become to clear up. And you begin to see that everything does fit in. And what is the ultimate scheme of things? Is that we would learn to fear God. We would learn to fear God. Everything is set up to fear, to teach people and lead people to fear God. But here's the funny thing. It's not just about your life. It's not just the world we live in. Do you realize the whole of creation, was set up to lead people to God? In fact, God makes it even more precise than that, because look at Colossians chapter 1. For in Him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and what? For Him. People ask me, what is the purpose of life? When they look at all that, and I say, this is the purpose of life. All things were created for Him. My question here is this. Will you worship Jesus in all situations? That is really what Ecclesiastes 3 to 5 is asking us. When you step out these doors, what's going to happen to you? I'll tell you what's going to happen. You might suddenly get a great job. Fantastic. Will you fear Jesus? Or you go out and you get bad news. It usually means you retrench. Will you fear Jesus? You actually get into a relationship. Will you fear Jesus? Or somehow your relationship goes south and you break up. Will you fear Jesus? You get news that your health is good and going well. Will you fear Jesus? Or suddenly you get tragic news that your health is in decline. Will you fear Jesus? You get great marks at uni. Will you fear Jesus? Or suddenly you failed your exam and you get kicked out. Will you fear Jesus? Though there be madness, there is method in it. Though we live in a very messy world, there's a time for everything under the sun. And everything is beautiful in its place so that we might learn to fear Jesus. Will you fear Jesus? Will you love Him? Will you worship Him all the days of life in any and every situation? Because that is how God has made everything. Even the details of your life, even details of our world, they all work with clockwork precision to lead people to love and to worship and adore Jesus all the days of life. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we look at this world and we see the futility and the mess and the madness of this world. It doesn't make sense too often. People working their guts out to get something but never able to rest and enjoy it. People coming to the top and everyone is cruel and no one ever content with them. And yet, Father, you tell us that you have made everything beautiful in its time so that we might all learn to fear you and to honor your Son. Father, when we step out these doors today, we don't know what the world is going to bring to us, whether good times or bad times, good news or bad news. But in all things, may we learn to love and to worship and adore your Son, for whom all things were created. In His mighty name we pray this. Amen.